the sky. Oh, they tell me of a home far away, so far away.
Five-time Grammy winner Marty Stewart has sung many ballads over the course of his long career, but his latest project called American Ballads is actually a book of beautiful black and white photographs he's taken of the many greats in country music that he's had the luck to know and work with. And for those of you who'd like to hear him sing, he will be performing tomorrow night at Joe's Pub with his fabulous superlatives from his latest double record called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. It's Marty, it's just great to have you join us once again. And we were just hearing the Staple Singers, not a group that I would associate with you, but you're on guitar there playing the guitar part that Pop Staples did on the original record?
Well, that's Mavis singing along. First of all, hello, Leonard. Nice to be on your show again. I love your show. That is Mavis singing with me and my fabulous superlatives playing Pop's guitar. The Staples were like family to me. And the way I got to know them was in the early 1990s. I was on MCA Records, and Don Was produced a record called Rhythm, Country, and Blues that paired country artists with rhythm and blues artists. And they said, who do you want to sing with? I said, the Staple Singers. And so the song The Weight was chosen for us to do together, which was kind of a suicide mission because it was done right at the first place, but it got us started. And we hit it off. Pops and I are both from Mississippi, and we just hit it off instantly and became family.
Well, that is a country gospel song.
Well, sure,
and there was
often
a lot of cross-fertilization between black gospel and white gospel. A lot of the songs that, songs that Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis sang, they got from people like Rosetta Tharpe. And then black groups and soloists sang songs like Great Speckled Bird and a whole bunch of other songs that came out of the white gospel.
Absolutely. Past. Well, the thing I learned about in the beginning of that relationship with the Staples is that Mavis said, oh, we listen to the Grand Ole Opry all the time. And I said, well, we listen to you all the time. And it's exactly what you're talking about. And I'm from Mississippi, so the church house was the common denominator for everywhere. It was kind of ground zero for all forms of music. But we loved, I grew up loving everything down there. And so theirs was a big part of it.
Getting back to your book, Susan Edwards writes in a foreword that there are those among us who make history and those who keep it. Marty Stewart does both. Did you think that you, when you were taking these photos, that you were keeping history?
Never in a million years. The first time that I got serious about photography was on my first trip to New York City in 1974. I was in Lester Flatt's band, a teenager, and we played a concert at New York University. And during the day, I took a walk into the village and walked into a bookstore, and I saw beautiful black and white jazz portraits up on the upper wall. They were taken by a fellow named Milt Hinton, who was a wonderful jazz bassist, we all know. But I didn't know Mr. Hinton took pictures, but it appeared to me that he had his bass in one hand and his camera in the other. And it appeared to me that afternoon that I now have the same access to the family of country music that Mr. Hinton perhaps had to jazz.
But you also, your mother took photographs.
Mother is a wonderful photographer.
She tend to do color, and you tend to do because you've included a few pictures.
Well, in the beginning, she shot all black and white. And when my sister and I came along in the early 60s, she kind of changed over to color for a more vibrant look. But I've always been a big fan of black and white photography.
Isn't it harder to get it processed, or do you do your own printer?
Leonard, I'm a dinosaur. I still shoot film, and I have to send it to North Carolina to be processed anymore.
Because there aren't too many places doing
no,
it.
But
you used to take it to your local drugstore.
Right, right. But now it's an act of Congress to get a roll of film developed.
But so you were actually performing for a while before you started taking those pictures.
Actually, I started performing on the road about 1972.
How old were you at the
12.
Time?
12. That was my first summer. I went out with the Sullivan family, the famous Sullivan family gospel singers from St. Stephens, Alabama. And my first year on the road was spent playing Pentecostal church houses, bluegrass festivals, and George Wallace campaign rallies.
You were still too young to get a driver's license when you started playing in Lester Flatt's band.
Yeah. I joined him when I was 13. So here's where a lot of the vision came from, because I didn't drive. I lived at his home.
I just have to make an announcement. President Obama is now speaking live from Martha's Vineyard, and you can watch the live statement right now on WNYC.org. It's expected that he will have comments about the unrest in Missouri and U.S. involvement in Iraq.
Okay,
Marty.
Where were we?
I don't know. We were talking about you being young and going to Grand Ole Opry when you were just how old?
I lived at Lester Flatt's house. I started with him when I was 13. So if I went anywhere, I had to go with him. So all of a sudden, my peers became his, the same as his, Ernest Tubb, Bill Monroe, Grandpa Jones, String Bean, Roy Acuff. And whether these fellows were sitting in a cafe or whether they were in a recording studio or in their costumes getting ready to go on stage, it looked like history in motion to me. And nobody ever seemed to have a camera other than a few fans. And so that's why I asked my mom to send me a camera.
But you also had to have an eye for framing the pictures. Is that something that just came naturally?
Well, it did. It did. But I love what the great country music photographer Les Leverett said. Don't show them the bad ones. That's how you become a good photographer.
Every photographer has a lot of pictures that they never want anybody to see. But you were also doing this at a time when the music was changing. Were you aware of that?
I was.
Your picture taking?
I was. And because of my age, I was a part of, in the early 1980s, of course, the sound, the look, the feel of country music as we had always known it kind of started changing. It went along the Urban Cowboy stream. And all of a sudden, the old-timers were kind of disregarded and put out to pasture. But I still saw a lot of beauty. It looked to me like what Mr. Edward Curtis used to shoot with the remnants of the Native American culture, the vanishing race. Porter Wagoner and his spangles looked like beauty to me. Johnny Cash still looked like Geronimo. You know, it was that kind of thing. And I couldn't turn loose of that just because times were changing.
And then there's also personal history here. You have a picture of Connie Smith that you took when you were just 12, which you have titled The Night I Met and Fell in Love with Connie Smith.
She came to my hometown, Philadelphia, Mississippi, to sing at the Choctaw Indian Fair in July 1970. And that was a big night at our house because she was my mom's favorite singer. And I thought we had a record called her album, her RCA Victor record called Miss Smith Goes to Nashville. And we kept it at the stereo. She looked so beautiful. And that's the night I told my mother I'm going to marry Connie Smith someday. I was 12 years old, you know. Took me 25 years to talk. Today's Connie Smith's birthday, so happy birthday to my girl.
How did you choose the order of the photographs in this book? You start out with what you call the last portrait of John R. Cash from 2003. It's taken from the side, almost as though he was turning toward you, looking down.
We were next-door neighbors. And after June passed away, I'd always make it a point, any time he felt like receiving company, I'd get over there and we'd have coffee. We'd just talk. And this was turned out to be 4 days before he passed away. It was the last portrait. I happened to have my camera with me, and for some reason that day, we wrote a song that afternoon. And
have you recorded it?
Yeah, it was called Hangman. I'd just come from Folsom Prison, and we had a big talk about things. And so we talked about that, and he was sitting there in a black shirt, and the sunlight was hitting him from behind. And he was beautiful, and there were three frames I shot. In the first two, he just looked like a tired old fellow. In the third one, I said, J.R., and he sat up straight and pulled that collar and became Johnny Cash. And it looks like an old presidential portrait to me.
Some of these pictures were shot during record sessions or performances. There's one of Lester Flatt from the back with his guitar upside down, strung around his neck. That's really striking. And many of the pictures make me wish I was there, although they kind of make you feel you were. Like, for instance, the one with Ernest Tubb as he's in the middle of laughing, almost moving out of the frame of the shot. But a lot of these are pictures that have nothing to do with performance. Bill Monroe and his chickens, and also in profile in his barn, you have Kitty Wells putting on lipstick.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to my mother's photography and Milt Hinton as inspiration and Edward S. Curtis. All three of those were influential photographers in my life. Mr. Curtis had, I think, the foresight to capture the dignity of the old tribe. And my mother had an informality, even though a family reunion kind of feel to her photography, but it was always elegant. And, you know, there was, and Mr. Hinton always had that unparalleled access. So all of those things come into play in these photographs to me.
Now, what drew you to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in Shannon County, South Dakota, which you cover in the part of the book called Badlands?
I've always been I had a deep love for Native American people. My hometown, Philadelphia, Mississippi, is the home of the Mississippi Band of Choctaws. But when I joined Johnny Cash's band in the early 1980s, he had a heart for those people. And he had done a record called Bitter Tears in the 60s, you probably remember. That was the song Peter LaFarge wrote about Ira Hayes, was like a flag-waving song. But I went with him and his band.
Ira Hayes, the Indian who was on Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima, that's right. And then came home to a tragic end. I went with the Cash band to Pine Ridge, and I asked John, I said, how come we're here? He said, this is the poorest county in the United States of America, and we're here to raise the flag of hope. And I fell in love with those people that night and never quit going back.
Well, we have a slideshow of images from the book on our show page at WNYC.org, and a selection of your photography is on exhibit in the Frist Center in Nashville.
That'll be running
through November 2nd in case anybody's going to Nashville. Is there a reason why your latest album, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, is a double record?
Because we could. It took 9 years to pull this project. I released two records in the meantime while I was working on this record. And side one of Saturday Night is raucous country music, and side two is really black gospel-inspired music.
And we heard Uncloudy Day from that. So in that case, you got Roebuck Staples' guitar. You've gotten a whole bunch of people's guitars. Merle Haggard's guitar. You got Roy Rogers' nudie suit.
Yeah.
So you're also collecting memorabilia?
It's a sickness, Leonard. You know, it goes back a long ways. But back with those days we were talking about, when the old world started disappearing, all of a sudden the treasures of it did too. And I noticed that, especially, I bought Patsy Cline's hand tool leather train case for $75 in a thrift store in Nashville.
Oh, boy.
And I thought, this is the family jewels getting away. So it started out in my bedroom, and now there's 20,000 pieces. It's a pretty serious collection.
How'd you form your band, and why'd you call it the Fabulous Superlatives? That's a double superlative.
Well, there's an old traditional Southern florist in Nashville called Emma's Florist. And they have this wonderful announcer that they've had for many, many years at the end of of his radio spots, and he has this deep, syrupy Southern brogue. He says, Carnations, Mums, Rhododendrons, Emma's the Superlative Florist. And we always thought, I loved the word, and we were on an airplane one day. I thought, let's call ourselves the Superlatives like Emma's Florist.
But then you got to live up to that.
Then somebody said, well, how about the Fabulous Superlatives? I said, even better. But the good part is the band can back it up. No problem.
How do you put a band like that together?
You don't. It's a divinely ordered band. I couldn't have done this in my wildest dreams. It just happened. But yeah. I knew from the first 5 minutes of the rehearsal that it was the band of a lifetime.
Have you ever missed a shot that you really regret?
Yes.
You didn't have the camera?
Yes. Willie Nelson's 60th birthday party on stage in Austin, and it was one of those all-star bands, and everybody mixed and mingled, and all forms of combinations of people on stage. But Willie and Bob Dylan were on stage singing Pancho and Lefty, and Willie's little boy Lucas at that time was standing next to his dad with his hand on his britches leg and his cowboy boots playing the harmonica.
We're going to go out with Jailhouse from the Saturday Night CD, but won't you be performing on October 6th at the Metropolitan Museum of Art?
At the closing of the
That's a weird venue for
Well,
you.
No, it's just right. At the closing of the Martin Guitar Exhibit. So we'll be there. Come see us.
Marty Stewart, American Ballads, the photographs of Marty Stewart. This is from Vanderbilt University Press. He has a CD called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, and he will be at Joe's Pub tomorrow night at 7:30 and 9:30. Ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org.
Always a pleasure, Leonard.
A jailhouse, she threw away.